Happy New Year! 2020 is starting off dramatically with the escalation of tensions in the Middle East. The world held its breath while the United States and Iran exchanged both blows and barbs. On the other side of the planet, South Koreans were also holding their breath. The Persian Gulf is extremely vital to Korea's economic well-being. Moreover, Iran is a country that has traditionally maintained extensive commercial and cultural exchanges with the Republic of Korea. Beyond risks to South Korea's heavily oil-dependent economy, Seoul has also been in discussions with the United States on potentially deploying its navy to participate in missions to keep the shipping lanes through the Straits of Hormuz open, just in case Tehran or its proxy forces look to close this vital waterway. For a little while, there was a real chance that Korean troops would be sent to an active war zone. In the days that followed, tensions fortunately de-escalated. But in the aftermath, the European Union has accused Tehran of renegating elements of the nuclear deal. Of course, the Trump administration had already abandoned the nuclear deal in May 2018. But Tehran's abrogation could lead to the reimposition of sanctions. And so, the situation remains deeply volatile. So it's a good time to review what risks South Korea faces if a conflict flares up in the Middle East. Would Korean troops be deployed to the region? How long could the South Korean economy last without its vital oil supplies? Are there alternatives? And what would this mean for negotiations with North Korea? We'll answer all these questions in the upcoming episode. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yang Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. We're joined today by KEI Senior Director and fellow Troy Stangaron. Troy, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We recently saw an escalation of tensions between the United States and Iran over the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Soleimani and subsequent missile attacks on bases hosting U.S. troops in Iraq. Now, both sides, both the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Iran and President Trump, seem to be de-escalating the conflict. But the event truly showed that the situation in the Middle East is very volatile. And of course, this didn't happen in a vacuum, and it could also happen again in the future. Could you maybe walk us through what happened in the region maybe since June of 2019?
I might go back just slightly further. I won't go back to 79, but the current chain of events most likely were set in play by the decision by the Trump administration to withdraw from the nuclear deal with Iran and to reimpose sanctions. Since June, maybe even slightly before, we've seen a rising set of skirmishes basically between the United States and Iran, with others at times getting caught in between. You had multiple ships that have been seized or attacked either directly by Iran or suspected to be by Iran. For example, the British had seized an Iranian vessel that was illegally shipping oil. Then a few weeks later, a British vessel was seized by the Iranians. You had the U.S. drone that was shot down by Iran and then the aborted strike by the United States that we all know about now. The largest escalation prior to this was most likely the attack on the Saudi oil facilities, which shut down half of their production for about 3 weeks at the time. It saw a spike in oil prices as capacity went down. So we've had this sort of back and forth to where each side has been threatening each other. Each side has been engaging in different acts or retaliation. The most recent provocation that led to the Soleimani assassination was specifically the attack by militias backed by Iran in Iraq on a U.S. base where a U.S. contractor was killed and different U.S. and Iraqi service members were injured. And that's sort of how we kind of got to this point.
Right. And I'm glad that you mentioned the attack on the Saudi oil pipelines and refining capacities in September of last year, because really that was not Iran itself undertaking a missile strike, but it was partners of Iran, maybe in Yemen. And of course, with the most recent protests you mentioned also, it was not Iranians per se, but it was agents of Iran in Iraq. And of course, we know about other Iranian-backed influences in throughout the region. So if there is a conflict between the United States and Iran, it could be at a wider level than just, you know, in the territory of Iran and even just in the Persian Gulf. And of course, all this matters to KEI and for Korean listeners and to South Korea, Because South Korea is an energy-dependent economy. It imports a significant amount of resources from the Middle East. And it has traditionally had an extensive commercial relationship with Iran and has acted as one of its most prominent buyers of condensate. But it's curious because one could also argue that since the reimposition of U.S. sanctions, South Korea has reduced its purchase of oil from Iran. So given this reduction of direct exposure to Iranian oil production, how will the ongoing tensions still affect South Korea?
They've actually completely cut off imports from Iran as a result of the U.S. sanctions. In terms of how does this directly affect South Korea, let me just walk you through a couple of things. About 44% or so of South Korea's energy usage is petroleum. Of that, about 70% through the first 11 months this year came from inside the Strait of Hormuz. So out of the petroleum, which is a significant energy source, the vast majority of it comes from the Middle East. If you look at LNG, it's less dependent, but even in that case, about 38% through the first 11 months came from the Middle East. So they're very dependent and they're very vulnerable to any disruption in the region. There's a couple ways that this would affect potentially South Korea. One, if a conflict were to escalate, oil prices continue to go up, increase costs. That then filters into other industries such as their petrochemical industry, which is in competition with other countries from China. So it start raising questions about how competitive they can remain if costs go up. China also would face costs, but perhaps not as much for different reasons. You also, though, have the broader, more important question beyond the cost question, which is if, as you note, this war extends and proxies become engaged and shipments get cut off, then you run into the issue of the reliability of supplies. The United States has been pushing for countries like South Korea, Japan included, to contribute to protecting the shipping lanes. Both South Korea and Japan have said they would, though it's still sort of unclear what steps they'll take. But the other factor here is that there is a question of the scale and the length of any conflict too. So if this was a long-lasting conflict, it would have potentially a significant impact on the South Korean economy. If this were a relatively short conflict, that could potentially be managed. South Korea, like the United States, has a strategic petroleum reserve. That strategic petroleum reserve is good for about 3 months. So South Korea would be able to weather that. There is a bit more oil stored in South Korea that it could potentially have access to because they have joint storage facilities with, for example, the UAE, which they have first drawing rights off. So there is some ability to manage this, but only if this were a short-term conflict. If this were to become an intense longer-term conflict, then there would be direct significant impacts in terms of energy shortages in South Korea.
Even some of those reserves that you mentioned, those shared reserves with the UAE, presumably those are in the UAE, and the shipments would still have to go through the Straits of Hormuz?
No. One of the things that actually some of the major Middle Eastern oil producers did to start dealing with geostrategic risk is placing oil outside the region for storage. Mm. So, for example, Saudi Arabia has, a fairly large storage facility in the Netherlands, if I remember correctly. There are some other Middle Eastern facilities in Japan as well. So they have tried to disperse some oil out. So there is this recognition, I think, even amongst Middle Eastern countries that they need to balance the broader geopolitical risk of the region against the needs to be able to ship oil out.
And as you mentioned, even with these measures, in the short term, you know, maybe South Korea won't have a supply crunch, but if the conflict does last longer, then there's definitely going to be challenges. And also, even within the medium term, when we see such increases in energy prices, South Korea is a net energy importer, as the South Korean industries use a lot of energy for its export goods, there will be significant economic consequences. Now, amidst all this, one of the interesting things that have been raised in policy discussions is that, you know, South Korea could simply turn to other oil producers. In particular, you know, the United States in the past 10 years with the shale gas revolution has been a major producer of both oil and natural gas. Observers have simply asked, why doesn't South Korea buy more oil from the United States? Is this an economical solution to the geopolitical challenges in the Middle East?
I think there's two things to consider here. One is setting aside the U.S. role now as the world's largest energy producer, if production from the Middle East, which overall as a group of countries is the largest source of oil in the world, the U.S. probably couldn't supply everyone. So you're still talking about potential shortages because other countries, obviously like Japan and China, are both largely dependent on the Middle East. So there's going to be issues of capacity. There's going to be questions about whether the U.S. would be able to take and actually export the types of volumes you might need if this were to go to a worst-case scenario. So there's a practical side of this, but there's also a technical side, which is that South Korean refineries are designed to take and refine the type of oil that comes from the Middle East to a large extent. The U.S. oil is of a different grade. They could make adjustments, but it would take time, obviously, to adjust your refineries to be able to refine the U.S. oil as opposed to the Middle Eastern oil. So there are technical obstacles potentially as well.
Beyond the United States, are there countries that could present as logical substitutes? Could they step up their production and perhaps mitigate some of the potential supply crunches that we might see if a conflict with Iran reduces supply from the Middle East?
Yeah, if we look at countries who might make the most sense for South Korea specifically, there are some slight differences, but Australian and Norwegian oil tends to be closer in terms of its grade, in terms of sulfur content and other things, to Middle Eastern oil. So they might be potentially viable alternatives for South Korea.
This is not a new situation for South Korea. South Korea has gone through this challenge of finding new sources of energy when sanctions were placed on Iran in the mid-aughts. It has faced these challenges every time there was a conflict in the Middle East. Every time oil prices go up, South Korea is faced with the challenge of better diversifying its energy mix. And it's been focused on this for quite a while. And I don't get the sense that South Korea is ignorant of the vulnerabilities that they face as a result of the geopolitical risks. And the incumbent Moon Jae-in administration in particular has been quite focused on bolstering non-carbon energy sources like renewables. Do you think the recent challenges in the Middle East might drive some of these domestic policies further? Do you think we will see kind of a drive towards more renewables or other energy policies in South Korea?
It definitely highlights the risk again. As you note, it's something that I think every administration has to have been aware of. Going back, 10, 15 years at least, administrations have put forward targets for increasing renewable energy, mostly which have not been met. You have seen in the last couple of years a slight uptick. I think you're going to see more of that in the Moon administration, not necessarily driven specifically by this, though this might help incentivize the need to move forward. One of the first major wind farms in South Korea is set to come online. The government itself is investing heavily, and so is Hyundai, in hydrogen technology, which would potentially relieve the need to take and import oil. They're looking at hydrogen for cars, for buses, these types of things. You also, depending on, and there are challenges in South Korea because it's not as windy as some other countries, but there are some areas that potentially could work. But depending on how you could deploy the wind power and how you sourced it, you could then make the hydrogen fuel carbon-free. What I mean by that is because what people don't realize is often to split the hydrogen, you have to use fossil fuels. And so there is a saving on carbon, but it's not obviously carbon-free. But if you could use electricity generated by wind power, you can eliminate that need. So I think you're going to start seeing more efforts in trying to advance and develop these types of technologies, which, one, would address South Korea's energy needs, but two, also have an economic incentive, is that if they're able to commercialize, it could become another export growth engine for South Korea as well as that technology was deployed around the world.
This is absolutely fascinating, especially the hydrogen technology. And you've written about these regulatory sandboxes in South Korea where the government is trying to promote experimentation with hydrogen technology, trying to jumpstart this and to accelerate the development of these. But realistically, how far away is South Korea from significantly reducing its current carbon dependency?
Probably a significant period of time. The UK is probably one of the better examples of an industrialized country doing it. They, this past year, for the first time, produced a majority, not over 50%, but I think it was about 48% of their energy from renewables. They've done that shift in a relatively short period of time, but the UK tends to be windier than the Korean Peninsula, so there's certain maybe innate advantages that they have over South Korea. Now, that being said, Korea hasn't looked much into tidal power and some other things, so there might be other options that Korea could do that would help get them there. But I would say it's probably going to be a more difficult challenge than it has been for the UK to get to a point to where your largest source of energy is renewable as opposed to carbon-based.
Amidst all this, we have to talk about the other major energy source that South Korea is currently not tapping, which is nuclear. Since the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident in Japan in 2010, South Koreans have been very wary of expanding its nuclear power capacity. And one of the platforms of the Moon Jae-in administration has been to stop the construction of new power plants and actually reduce South Korea's dependency on nuclear power. Do you think the current geopolitical risks in the Middle East might shift the needle on that policy outlook?
I think potentially. The Moon administration's policy has been somewhat controversial. You had a case to where there were two plants early on and they did a public citizens forum and the citizens wanted the plants to stay. There are economic reasons. The industry has been trying to promote the sale of South Korean nuclear technology abroad. And they argue that's hard to do if you have a situation to where South Korea no longer has nuclear power. But it also comes down to a risk factor in the sense that if petroleum is no longer as reliable as it could be, you need domestic sources. Obviously, you could do coal and you could import coal from Australia, but that has obviously other environmental risks. And they go beyond just the issue of climate change. Right now, you have significant air pollution issues in South Korea. This would increase that. So there's a strong pushback against that. So you start running out of potential options, and nuclear is one of them. But I think what would be more likely to happen rather than necessarily construction of new plants would be to either extend the life of current plants or to not take certain plants offline that are scheduled to go offline in the future. And that's probably what we're likely to see going forward rather than a boom in construction.
Especially since, as you mentioned, we're still somewhat far away from actualizing more of a carbon neutral energy mix for South Korea. I guess nuclear power would be an easy source that South Korea could rely on.
Yeah, and there's other options too on the nuclear side. One of the concerns in South Korea has been, what do you do with the spent waste? They don't have a lot of storage capacity, but there are new fast breeder reactors that are being designed, which in theory could take and run off of basically spent fuel. And if that's the case where you could recycle this fuel, that would help alleviate some of it. Now, that obviously would mean building new reactors, but you know, there are maybe other avenues depending on how the technology over the next decade or so develops as well that could be on the table.
All this suggests that, you know, it's really a boon that South Korea is such a technologically advanced economy, because it seems like this technology is the key vehicle through which South Korea is mitigating a lot of the geopolitical risks coming from the Middle East.
There's one other thing to keep in mind too about the mix here. It's not clear what will happen yet, but the current or the new commission in the European Union has put forward what they refer to as their Green New Deal. One aspect of that would be a border adjustment tax for carbon in exports to meet the content of European production. South Korea tends to probably have one of the higher levels of carbon content. So there may be a need to move into some of these things and to move more quickly away from coal simply to take and maintain competitiveness within the European market, depending on what the Commission ends up doing.
The other factors other than geopolitics might also be in play. Of course, South Korea being a very export-dependent economy that is reliant on maintaining competitiveness in these markets. Now, going back to something that you said earlier, you did mention that South Korea, alongside other countries like Japan, were thinking about supporting the United States in protecting shipping lanes through these very vulnerable areas like the Strait of Hormuz and across the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. And indeed, in December, before the most recent escalation of tensions between Iran and the United States, Korean newspapers were reporting that the government was resolved to dispatch troops and expand the mission of the existing Korean naval forces that are currently engaged in anti-piracy efforts in the Horn of Africa. Now, South Korea is no stranger to dispatching troops to the region. South Korea participated in the 2003 operations in Iraq. As mentioned, they currently have naval troops in the Horn of Africa, again, in anti-piracy activities. But if troops are deployed amidst increasing tensions between Iran and the United States, beyond the possibility of troop casualties, what are some other risks that South Korea might be taking on?
The first question would become, what type of deployment is this? Is this something to where they're independently escorting South Korean vessels, in which case it might be seen as a largely neutral type of activity? or do they join a broader fleet with the U.S., in which case there's the risk that if a conflict did break out that they're seen as a potential belligerent with Iran or its proxies. So you have this risk to calculate in terms of how any mission would be perceived within the region based on what actions South Korea took. But there's also domestic constraints in terms of how popular this type of mission would be. And the government has the ability to take and retask the troops that are already based around the Horn of Africa to undertake this mission. But they need to get authorization to take and expand the mission beyond that. So there might be limits in terms of what South Korea could deploy. Now, one also, this is an evolving situation. You don't know if there were shipments to start being cut off, if that then might actually aid the government in getting authorization to protect South Korean ships. But I think the question might come down to, is this something they do independently, or is this something that they do in coalition with the United States, or maybe if not with the United States, with a group of other like-minded nations who want to ensure that freedom of navigation is protected and that their oil supplies are protected but don't want to be caught in the crosshairs between the United States and Iran.
Right. I mean, this must be quite an awkward position for South Korea because they have quite an intimate relationship with Iran. I mean, it goes back decades. Iran and South Korea have been commercial partners before the nuclear crisis arose. Iran ported South Korean cars. Even one of the major avenues in Seoul is Tehran Avenue, and there's a Seoul Avenue in Tehran. So there's a lot of conflicting thoughts, I'm sure, in South Korea about all this.
And even when the nuclear deal was originally concluded between the United States and Iran, I think Park Geun-hye, if I remember, was the first foreign leader to go to Tehran. So there are commercial ties. They have tried to maintain good relations with both countries. And, you know, that's one reason why they might not want to be caught in the middle.
Now, are there other additional developments that might be shaping South Korea's decision to deploy troops to the Middle East?
In addition to the calculations that South Korea has to make within the region, it also has to balance its relationship with the United States. The Trump administration had been pushing for essentially a 400% increase in the burden sharing for the deployment of U.S. troops to South Korea. You have a situation to where, you know, they might be coming down, but the U.S. is pushing back on what had been rumors recently that they were coming up with a more reasonable number. So you have not just the SMA or the burden sharing side of this, but you also have this question of, you know, wanting to maintain good relations with the United States because of North Korea. You know, right now you have a situation to where those talks between North Korea and the United States seem to be potentially breaking down. Kim Jong-un has said he no longer feels bound by his prior pledges to not necessarily test an ICBM or nuclear weapon. And so I think from the South Korean perspective, you want to make sure you have a good relationship with the United States so that way you can continue to encourage the United States to be reaching out to North Korea so that way this situation doesn't escalate as well.
I'm glad you mentioned North Korea because that's obviously an elephant in the room. The triangle between Iran, North Korea, United States, and South Korea, I guess it's a rectangle now, is quite complex. I mean, Iran and North Korea obviously have strange commercial and geopolitical ties in terms of weapons development in the past. How do you think the ongoing developments in Iran is shaping North Korea's approach to U.S. overtures for denuclearization talks?
From a perspective of public diplomacy, it will probably go into the rhetoric in terms of why the United States can't be trusted, why North Korea needs a nuclear weapon. In a practical sense, probably not much. If Kim Jong-un has made a strategic decision to test an ICBM, I wouldn't expect this to deter him. The United States has shown that, one, it's not looking to move troops out of the region, so it's not as though the U.S. is taking and going to be taking its eye off of Northeast Asia. But it also hasn't shown under the Trump administration, outside of sanctions and the maximum pressure policy, to be willing to take the type of kinetic actions that it's taken with Iran. So I think from the North Korean perspective, this is interesting. You take note of how the situation develops. You run this through in terms of explaining why you're justified in your position. But practically speaking, it's probably not changing much of the thinking in Pyongyang right now.
Well, that's one good news to come out of this crisis, that it's not actually shifting the needle for Pyongyang's worldview. To close, I would like to ask if there are things that American audiences miss when they think about South Korea's involvement in the Middle East, and especially vis-a-vis its relationship with Iran? Are there things that we're simply not taking into consideration when we, you know, engage in policies in the Middle East that affect South Korea?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned some of this earlier, that, you know, there's this long-term economic relationship. And it wasn't simply that South Korea imported oil from Iran. It had large construction contracts. After the nuclear deal was done, it had run up about $5 billion in contracts. It signed contracts, for example, to build new oil tankers because Iran needs to update its fleet. So, you know, there's been economic costs in terms of lost production for South Korea. On a more basic level, because of the way the sanctions are playing out, you had about 2,000 small and medium enterprises who did business with Iran, you know, not necessarily large amounts of business, but who now are in a situation to where those things aren't viable anymore. At one point, I think, you know, something like half the cell phones in Iran were like Samsung or LG. You know, there is this broader cost in the relationship. It's not as though when we look at it, this is simply about oil. Yes, the oil purchases go down and South Korea or Japan or other countries buy from other suppliers. There is this broader economic relationship that these countries have with Iran, and that relationship is also impacted. And so I think when we look at this, we need to realize that there's a more holistic picture here that we're often missing when we focus simply on the oil exports.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Troy Stangarone for joining us. Throughout the episode, I could not help but think about the history of Iran. In many ways, it is a story that would be familiar to readers of Korea's pre-modern history. Foreign interventions, exploitation by countries with colonial ambitions, and the forcible removal of democratic governments that was facilitated by the geopolitical environment. Just as it would be misguided for policymakers to approach the Korean Peninsula without a proper understanding of both North and South Korea's history, it would be equally wrong to not consider the long and tragic history of Iran when looking at current developments. These events deserve to be contextualized, with history going back to the rivalry over the country between the British and Russians in the 19th century, the British-backed coup by Reza Pahlavi in 1921, and the American-backed coup against Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. This in addition to the better-known history of Iran after the 1979 revolution, are vital to our understanding of current events. With that, see you next week.